This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Labyrinth, looking at the mystery of mazes.
That's a bit of a tongue twister there, eh, Jules?
Yes, I only discovered that when I attempted to say it.
But you got it right first time, huh?
I always do. I don't. I don't.
I couldn't even say it, so it's a good thing that you announced the titles. So how should we begin this episode? We have so many labyrinths and mazes to speak about.
We do. And I didn't realise quite how old the concept of a labyrinth, or rather a maze, because the labyrinth is synonymous with the word maze in English, but it actually means something slightly more complicated in Greek, and it's a pre-Greek word. It's Minoan originally, so it's sort of pre-Bronze Age, the idea.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't realise it was that old, but it really is. But the word labyrinth sort of probably entered common parlance, as it were, from the myth of the king of Minos, who asked the artificer Daedalus to create a maze or a labyrinth for him on Knossos in Crete. And there, from there, we got the story of the Minotaur in the maze.
Yes. And he made the labyrinth because his wife had intimate sessions with a bull, I believe. Was it a bull?
It was Zeus, disguised as a bull. Zeus doing his experimentation in interspecies erotica, as usual.
Of course, naturally. Oh, because I heard it was originally because he was having an affair with her, so Hera made her fall madly in love with a bull.
You might be right, but I know that Zeus at some point had actually disguised himself as a bull, hasn't he?
I mean, there's probably several versions of the story.
Yeah,
the point is, Queen gave birth to monstrous bull baby creature.
Yep.
And the king's automatic reaction was, let's put it in a maze.
Yes, let's shut it in a maze. Obviously, we can't kill it because it's a god-born child. So instead of socialising it and perhaps trying to accept it a bit, no, we'll stick it in a maze in the dark. And we'll send women down to it.
And feed it humans. Perfect.
As you do. Obviously, part of this comes from the whole idea of, I say bull charming, but it's not actually charming as in, like, providing the bulls with flowers. It's the bull dancing.
I don't think anyone at any point went, hey, so bull charming, so do I give it flowers? How does it work? I don't think that's a thing that anyone ever got confused about.
But it was a tradition, wasn't it? They used to send 12 youths and 12 maidens who would then learn how to bull dance, which was extremely dangerous because, you know, bulls don't like it when you somersault over their backs.
No, they don't. And I can understand that. I don't like it when people somersault over my back.
Does that happen a lot?
More than you'd think.
Right, okay. And you don't even have horns.
That you know of.
That I know of. But yeah, that's where part of the legend came from. Anyway, we're going off tangent a bit on the whole maze thing.
We are. But it is interesting that actually originally the maze that we all kind of think of, it was there not to keep people out, but rather to keep something in.
Yes. Yes, it was. And there are older, you know, there are contemporary with Bronze Age and, you know, perhaps sort of in between Iron Age, you know, Bronze Age, Iron Age type mazes as well, which suggest that maybe the uses were something slightly different. But in all fairness, we don't really know. We don't, you know, if they were used for ritual purposes, it's lost. It's lost in the mists of time now. It predates consistent written language in most cultures. But what is interesting is the fact that we have carvings of the mazes and things, and there's a lot of similarities between them. And it's interesting that lots of different cultures, from the Native Americans to the Minoans to the Celts in Britain, to the Picts, who predated the Celts, all have these sort of mazes as part of their mystical belief system. the Egyptians as well.
Hmm.
And it is interesting because there must have been a limit to how much sort of cross-pollination of culture there was going on at the time these carvings were created. So it seems to be one of those great archetypal ideas that either comes from a common ancestor, in the same way that sort of perhaps Proto-Indo-European language roots did, or perhaps, you know, it's just one of those things like werewolves and vampires and ghosts and things where all the different cultures pretty much came up with a similar idea at the same time.
Clearly, because they existed. Mystery solved.
Yes. Well, mazes definitely do exist, mostly because we made them.
What? I thought they were just myth. Jules, you're telling me that mazes are real?
Yeah, they're real.
Oh my god. This changes everything.
They like to disguise themselves as ordinary doorways that you go through every day, but you go through and find yourself in the maze instead, then you get hopelessly lost and it digests you over 1,000 years.
Oh. Okay.
Beware Thanks for the heads maze. Up.
There's a story in there, actually, where the maze isn't disguising, hiding anything. The maze itself is the monster.
There we go. Brought to you by Dissecting Dragons. Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of interesting mythology and mystical belief around mazes. If we come sort of over to our side of Europe, if you like, and look at sort of Celtic Britain, there were lots of different mazes that were sort of cut into the turf as well. And it seems that it was done for like a processional dance. So as part of a ritual belief. Again, you can link that to sort of the four great fire festivals and the four lesser fire festivals of the Celtic year. So we've got a rough idea. But the actual symbol of the maze itself, if you sort of Google Celtic mazes, and you look at the sort of more rounded ones, and then you Google a picture of the human brain, and you compare the two, they're curiously similar in the sense of, you know, the folds and little rills in the naked human brain, which I know is quite gross. It's very similar to sort of the way that these rounded mazes are set up. And the two are supposed to be linked in mysticism, as in, you know, when you go into the maze, actually what you're conquering is by going further into yourself, into your own mind.
So the question is whether ancient Celts opened up a person's brain and went, hey, well, this would be fun.
We're pretty sure that they did indulge in cannibalism, and cannibalism wasn't in the case of, you know, we're just going to, we'll lop that leg off and roast that because that looks good. It was a case of, no, the head's the important part. We'll bring the heads home, which is why they tended to behead some of their enemies.
Yeah.
And if it was a worthy enemy, they'd crack the skull open, they'd all have a little bit of brain so that they imbibe the strength of the enemy. Power.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sure they noticed what brains look like.
Just as they're eating. Have you ever noticed the intricacy of the... Shut up! Give me the frontal lobe.
I mean, they were probably doing some pretty heavy-duty herbal drugs at the time as well. So somebody going, oh my god, a brain, it's a maze. Dude, it's totally a maze. It's not really that unusual.
I love the idea that they went, dude... Dude, look at this brain.
Yeah, in Celtic, obviously.
Obviously in Celtic, yeah.
It's sort of in the early Brythonic languages, whichever it was at the time, they said
they must have had an equivalent of dude and bro, clearly.
Yeah, I must have done.
good.
So that's a little bit sort of early stuff on mazes. The one thing I will mention, because this is quite an interesting little sidebar, and it doesn't involve brains, you'll be glad to know. Is the Welsh word for labyrinth or maze is Caer Dwa, and that means a fortress of turns. And there seems to be a sort of language link between Caer Dwa and the original pre-Greek word for Troy. There isn't a great deal of evidence between, you know, Wales and Troy having been in contact, although some people have tried to advance that theory. But it's interesting that Troy is inextricably linked with ancient maze mythology because Troy itself was supposed to be considered a sort of maze.
Mm-hmm.
So I always found that interesting. But the Caer Dwa of Wales, none of which actually still properly exist, were turf paths generally. But they always had a hillock in the middle, a timpan. Timpath, sorry, timpath.
Not a tin pan.
Not a tin pan, no. Not generally. Well, they might have done that.
Ta-da!
If you the centre and you had Welsh rarebit, I don't know.
Sorry, I mishear things sometimes.
That was so funny. Oh, God. But one theory which is interesting and does hold a little bit of weight is that Glastonbury Tor may well have been one of the largest Caer Dwa. as in a processional way cut into the turf with dead ends and turns that you had to follow. And modern imaging technology does actually support that theory, then it may well have been.
Oh, I really like that idea, actually.
So Glastonbury Tor itself could have been just this huge, if you like, huge ritual dance.
I really do like that idea, actually. That it's very interesting that mazes, which are so synonymous with protection and kind of threat, could have actually been something to do with worship instead.
Yeah, if you look at sort of Celtic patterns, Celtic and actually early Saxon embroidery, mm-hmm. the way that the pattern is enclosed, usually within a border, and Celtic knotwork as well, the whole idea of it was to concentrate the focus of the power, the focus of the creativity of the art or whatever, within those lines so that you could control it, because otherwise it was considered this huge amorphous force that might be destructive. Which I think is an interesting look at the mindset.
If you can't control it, kill it.
And it was the same with mazes, obviously. It was a case of, well, whether you look into things like ley lines and things like that. If you were going to carve things like Caer Droa into the earth, then you mm-hmm. were potentially trying to force that same earth energy, for lack of a better word, into the same path. And then if you get a group of people who may or may not have been a bit high on various different types of mushroom, all dancing on a particular night with fire and whatever, in a particular set ritual formation. I mean, we can all put ourselves into an ecstatic state through dancing. You know, even if you can't dance at all, you can pretty much put yourself into an ecstatic state down your local club. You probably shouldn't, but you can do. So imagine what it was like when it was an organised dance like that with lots and lots of people that had been rehearsed so that your muscle memory pretty much took over as your brain just accessed a higher level of consciousness, if you like.
Well, I think often that makes me think of that scene in Outlander, series.
Yeah, with the standing stones.
Yeah, that dancing scene. That was very mesmerising, actually, just to even watch. And you kind of got that real sense. So actually, I'm trying to imagine that now on a bigger scale, and that's actually really spectacular.
Yeah. Yeah, it is really interesting. But as I said, a lot of this is speculation because we don't know exactly what mazes were created for. But initially, it wasn't so that people could get lost in them. Although sometimes, I think the idea obviously was that if you were unprepared and you entered a maze, then you would get lost.
That's so malicious.
Well, yeah, it is a bit sort of, you've got to get this right the first time, haven't you?
Do this right or you'll regret it.
But it's obviously something that stayed in our consciousness because, or stayed in our subconscious rather, because it's something that just crops up time and time again within various different types of our storytelling, speculative fiction now.
Yeah, it does. Now, you mentioned that there was a difference between mazes and labyrinths.
I think the idea is that labyrinths are supposed to be like on a much, much larger scale.
Okay.
And there might be a slight difference in intention for usage. It's certainly, the words are synonymous in English.
Yeah.
But I think the whole point was King Minos saying to Daedalus that basically he didn't want just a maze. He wanted like the biggest maze ever.
So, yeah. It was practically a prison. That's what it really was.
Yeah. Build me something that is impossible to navigate without the secret. In the same way that you had the pharaohs who wanted their pyramids, which were essentially tombs, built in a way that people couldn't find a way into them.
And yet
they do. I mean, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And obviously they did excavate a Bronze Age site at Knossos where they believe the original labyrinth and the labyrinth concept came from.
That's so fantastic.
We will find these things because, you know, people are interested, and when they're curious, they won't leave things alone, even whether it's good for them or not. But yeah, the idea was to make it as secret as possible, I suppose.
Hmm. Okay. All right, then. So of our long, very, very, very long list of sort of mazes and movie, I guess the one we really should probably start at, having discussed the Minotaur, is Labyrinth itself.
Yes, definitely. And not just because it's one of my favourite films of all time. This would be the film with Jennifer Connelly and David Bowie in it. And lots of little goblin dudes. as well.
Yeah, and puppets. So many puppets.
You're not a fan of puppets, are you?
No, I don't really like them.
Okay. But the story itself is, in a way, it's a classic fairy tale. And it is based on the idea of the Ulfkonig, which is, you know, the elf king or the goblin king in Germanic folk tradition.
Yes.
Who used to steal young girls to be his bride. And so, you know, the girl had to kind of be tricked into going willingly. So quite often the Ulfkonig would kidnap one of her relatives so that she would go and say, yeah, okay, I'll marry you then if you let them go. I don't think it's necessarily a sound strategy. I mean, that's kind of like if a bloke fancies you, he starts going out with your best friend to get close to you. And like that kind of puts him in the friend zone for the rest of his life, strategy wise. I just don't think that works. But according to these folk tales, that was the idea.
I just, to be honest though, if David Bowie turned up at my door, sort of in a cloud of glitter, and said, "Come with me to be my queen," I'd probably go, "Yeah."
Well, no, well, maybe not now, but you know, at the time, maybe. Yeah. Because it's like, okay, so you have magic, and you have all these cool creatures and things. Yeah, maybe I'm in.
I just one of my favourite lines of that is, "I move the stars for no one, but I move them for you." And you're like, yeah, how many girls have you said that to? David Bowie, I don't believe you. But no, it was a fantastic film. And as you say, the storyline is very good. And it was interesting because it is obviously based on this very Germanic story. But the labyrinth itself has more... at the time I just assumed it was Greek. I assumed it was this merger.
Yeah, it looks like a mixture of... I mean, there's little bits in there that look like Hampton Court maze, and there are bits that look like the overview of the maze at Knossos, and various other bits and pieces. So yeah, it really does. It doesn't look...
And there is a kind of Minotaur-like creature in there as well.
Do you mean Ludo?
Yes, Ludo.
Well, I suppose with the horns, maybe, but I mean, he's friendly, so...
Yeah, but that's what I always thought. I always thought he was the kind of Minotaur-like creature, but then that was the thing. Everything was turned up on its head, so fairies were unfriendly, and the Minotaur was actually fine. Of course, fairies are unfriendly, really, yes, but... Oh, God, I said it! Said it.
What I liked about it, especially, was that journey through the labyrinth was really just her having a journey through her own personality and learning which bits of her childhood she needed to keep in order to be a complete person and which bits she needed to let go of now. Because she wasn't really happy in herself. She didn't really want to completely grow up. She wanted the fantasy.
Yeah, she did. But at the same time... she wanted to be treated like an adult, but at the same time, she still wanted to be a child.
Yeah. Or rather, I think she wanted to be the child in that family, because obviously there was a new baby.
Yeah.
As well. So, I mean, it was really interesting. It packs so much in. It's family dynamics. It's a journey of the self. It's on some level, it's a sort of love story that never really happens.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, she chooses herself and her family over the fantasy. And it's a story about friendship, so it's just such a great film. It's hilariously funny.
But yeah, it is interesting that actually in this case, the labyrinth is into itself. I mean, she spends obviously the majority of the story getting through the labyrinth, but actually the labyrinth is this physical construct for what's happening, her internal turmoil and her internal journey, which I really, really like. So in this sense, actually, the thing that she needs to overcome is herself.
Yeah, very, very definitely. And, you know, obviously her big flaw, I suppose, is that she's really quite self-involved at the beginning. She's not a bad person, but she doesn't really think about anybody else.
No, but then,
You could say that's a classic part of being a teenager, though.
Yeah, but she is a teenager. So, but actually, to be honest, the characters at the beginning are, they are all kind of self-involved. They're all there for their own kind of reasons, except for Ludo.
Yeah, apart from Ludo.
So yeah, I think the most annoying part of that film was the bit where she met the worm and she was going to go one way and he said, no, no, never that way, go the other way. And, he used to be like, whew, she'd gone that way, she would have gone straight up to the castle. And I was so annoyed.
I think that's the point though, isn't it? We're supposed to see her fail really early on, and she does. And that's a really big failure in a way, because she just hasn't learned how to ask the right questions yet.
Yeah, she hasn't. But it was a very good movie and it was a very good story. And that was... I think it was a big trend setter when it came to labyrinths and sort of mazes and stories. And the idea that suddenly, because obviously there have been mazes around castles quite often. And I don't know if you've ever been to, you know, well, obviously you've been to a castle. Sorry, this is you. There's no way you couldn't have been to a castle. But, you know, it's the whole, you go and check out the maze, don't you?
Yeah, definitely.
And so there's this kind of link between castles and mazes. But I don't think it had never really been done in that way before. Not in sort of very popular media, other than the Minotaur.
No, you're right. It hadn't. It was it was a new take on the whole idea.
Mm-hmm. And I think it set a trend.
Yeah, I think so. And obviously later on, there are obviously books and films. Another one that's worth looking at is Pan's Labyrinth.
Yes, which is terrifying.
Which is moderately terrifying. Guillermo del Toro. So obviously peopled with really weird and not entirely well-intentioned creatures. And I think that, I mean, they're much more fairy-ish type other folk in Pan's Labyrinth, aren't they? Rather than they're really like the old gods. They're not like sort of slightly mischievous goblins.
No, they are. They are the old gods, and the F word. Not tricking me again.
What if I just let you off for this episode?
Okay, thank you. So yeah, they are very much fairies. But again, it is interesting between this link of fairies and mazes.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, whilst in Labyrinth they were these kind of bumbling goblins, the whole myth of the Elf King is still a fairy myth.
Yeah, it's actually quite a terrifying myth.
Yeah.
Because there's a sort of proto-Germanic story, which I think it comes from, of the Dokalfar, where... Mm-hmm. If you wanted favours from them, they could pretty much do whatever you want, but the price was high. And what they most liked was young girls given to them as a yielding, because they were a male race and they couldn't reproduce by themselves. So they wanted human women for that.
Which I can get. I mean, but... sorry, I'm not sympathetic with it. But
it's like, sounded a bit like you were in their corner then.
No, it was just that, like, it's just like, so what do we want? What do we need? Well, we have no women. Ah,
yeah. I mean, actually, the first story I ever had published was called The Yielding and was about this very thing. And it was something that on Beltane, mm-hmm. young girls were tricked or drugged and coerced down there and traded for favours from the Dokalfar, and they were all sort of slightly deformed. There was something slightly off and wrong about them.
What, the women or the...
No. The dark elves.
Right, yes, that makes more sense. So yeah, that's a rather... It does have very scary connotations, and there are some very, very scary bits as well, because it is about this loss of self, which comes into, again, a lot of fairy tales, the losing of oneself, the losing of one's name, the losing of one's memories.
Yeah.
In order to become something new.
Yeah, definitely.
And that appears in Labyrinth. Do you think there's elements of that in Pan's Labyrinth as well? The loss of self?
I think so. Although I think she starts, because it's actually a child in Pan's Labyrinth, and she's sort of just coming up to about 11, 12 years old, isn't she? So she's prepubescent. Yeah. And mother's expecting a baby, and she's her mother's married basically a German Nazi officer
mm-hmm.
for safety, and her world, her actual physical world, is very, very dark. So she does trade, I suppose, favours with the fair folk, which is never a good idea, as we know.
Nope.
And she is supposed to negotiate the labyrinth for this satyr-type creature, who is never actually called Pan in the film, by the way, but I think that was what we're supposed to associate him with.
Yeah.
And ultimately, she does reach her character arc at the end and discover what she needs to do, but I wouldn't say it's a happy ending.
Nope. It is not a happy ending. Though there is a very satisfying bit in it.
Yeah. Yeah, there is. And it is just really quite disturbing. The whole thing's got that low-key, once again, old version fairy tale feel about it.
Yeah. I think one of the very kind of poignant scenes in Pan's Labyrinth is actually the mandrake scene.
Yes, I was thinking of that.
Talk through that with me a little bit.
It's been a long time since I've seen the film.
I've only ever seen scenes of it. I couldn't bring myself to watch the whole thing. I was too scared.
Basically, the mother, who is extremely pregnant, does start to... It appears she starts to miscarry. So the girl goes into the labyrinth and trades for a mandrake root, which she puts in a saucer of milk under the bed, and the mother starts to get better. This is just standard mystical, you know, find yourself an old grimoire, flick through it for mandrake, and you can pretty much find this entire spell, probably.
Yeah.
Milk and blood, that's what you feed a mandrake root on. There are various other bits and pieces to it as well. So I think there's always an element in Pan's Labyrinth of wondering how much of this is actually happening in the girl's head, and it's her escaping the horrible reality.
Yeah.
Of the time of, you know, World War II Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And how much of it
is actually real.
Yeah. But her new stepfather finds the mandrake and isn't happy. He's, you know, a proper Teutonic man of his age and is a Nazi to boot and just does not have time for fantasy like this. And he crushes the mandrake root and her mother dies.
Yeah.
In childbirth.
Doesn't he also throw it into the fire?
Something like that, I think.
Yeah. And mandrakes are interesting. I won't talk too much about mandrakes. Because that's not what this episode is about. But mandrakes are interesting. Because they do appear in a lot of fiction. I mean, you get them in Harry Potter. And there is something incredibly creepy about them. Because it's this human plant baby thing that is terrifying.
Have you ever held a mandrake root?
I've seen them. I wouldn't touch it.
They do look a bit human.
They do.
They do look a bit human.
So yeah, that I think that's probably one of the most poignant moments in the film. Is the mandrake scene.
Definitely,
because
it
does make you really question, is this real or is this not real?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And she's paid a really high price for that mandrake root as well.
Yeah.
Which is what makes it, you know, aside from the fact her mother's going to die, that's what makes it quite crushing, is the fact that she really gave up quite a lot in order to get the mandrake root. She went through hell. She actually gave up probably part of herself and made a mistake. Moving on from Pan's Labyrinth to Labyrinth by Kate Moss.
Yes.
And there was a pretty good TV series of this book as well. And I have to say, to be honest, I read the book and I got so bored because of the way it was written. The style just didn't really entice me. But I did enjoy the TV series. And it is all about the Cathars, who were a Gnostic Christian revivalist group in the 13th century in parts of Italy and southern France.
Right.
Languedoc, I think, is the main place it's set in the book. It's just really interesting. You have a woman from the 21st century who goes on an archaeological dig. You know, you can go on archaeological digs just as a volunteer because they're always up for people like to fetch and carry and, you know, brush bits of dirt off. She finds an item that she accidentally keeps. She doesn't mean to keep it, but she touches it and it makes her pass out. And then when she you know, comes to later on, she finds that, you know, it's she's still got it. And she doesn't take it back in the end because a trail of murders starts happening. And when that happens, sometimes keeping the object is the only protection you've got.
Yeah.
But she starts to get memories of a woman who lived during the 13th century when the Cathars were being persecuted. Because obviously the Catholic Church did not like anybody existing outside its doors, its welcoming arms. Yes. So they tended to kill off heretics, and they especially, with bloodthirsty enthusiasm, liked to kill off other sects of Christianity.
Naturally.
As all predators will try to do with their rivals.
This is getting a bit personal, Jules.
No, it's a simple statement of fact. It's just that's what they do. Check out any religion you like. This is what they do. This isn't personal to Catholics. The Catholics just, you know, made a quite successful business of it.
Yes, they did.
So it's sort of a reincarnation story as well, and the two mm-hmm. stories interweave between each other. So you've got the woman who lives in Languedoc as a Cathar and her life interweaving with the woman from the 21st century who's like, there's something really weird going on, and why are people hunting me down? And what it all comes down to is the woman from Languedoc, the Cathars, actually mm-hmm. have the secret of the entrance to the labyrinth. The labyrinth is in the cave where the archaeological dig was originally. Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to give you eternal life if you can walk the labyrinth correctly.
Right.
And this does play into a bit of, because there are Christian mazes that are dotted all over the place as well that date back to, you know, the 10th century and before. And if you were able to tread them in the correct form, you could ask for healing for a member of your family and things like that. So it plays mm-hmm. into the whole Christian mythology.
Yes.
So I quite liked that as a twist on the whole labyrinth idea.
That is interesting, actually, to the link between in Christianity and again, labyrinths being suddenly becoming these things of hope, where if you get it, something good will happen to you, and it won't just be treasure, it won't just be survival, you will earn something.
Yeah.
That is interesting. I'm trying to, there is another example of something like that, where a labyrinth is used as a trial. Well, labyrinths are actually, we'll come into trials and labyrinths in a minute, because actually I've seen two things where a labyrinth has been used as a trial. What others do you have that you want to discuss?
I was going to passing mention for a book that came out this year called Winter Song by S.J. Jones, mm-hmm. which again is, some people have said they think it's a retelling of Labyrinth. It's not, it's a retelling of the Earl Conning. But and Christina Rossetti's The Goblin Market, it sort of mashes it all together in quite a satisfying way. But mm-hmm. once again, it's the heroine has to navigate her way through a labyrinth.
Right.
In order to leave in the end. But it is an interesting look at finding yourself by being subsumed by something that pulls you underground and then having to navigate your way out of it again.
And who's that by?
S.J. Jones.
S.J. Jones. I will keep that in mind. Thank you. So, looking at trials.
Yes.
I think it's fair to say that we can take Harry Potter off. That was the third and final trial, was a labyrinth.
Yeah, in fact, you can tick off Harry Potter twice, because if you think about the tasks he has to accomplish to get to the Philosopher's Stone in the first book, technically mm-hmm. that all takes the form of a labyrinth.
This is true.
It's not physically a maze in the same way, but it's a series of tests, and labyrinths tend to have series of tests for you to accomplish in order for you to get further.
Yes. Okay.
But yes, the main one, obviously, is the fourth book, The Goblet of Fire, and it is the Triwizard Tournament, the ill-fated Triwizard Tournament, which Harry didn't actually really want to enter. And which caused so much suffering.
There was, as well, an episode of Merlin, BBC Merlin, that involved a labyrinth, if I recall. It was so long ago. Yes, it was The Labyrinth of Gedreth. Switched yeah. up. And yes, that what happened was a curse was put onto Camelot because Arthur killed a unicorn. And so he had to go through a series of trials to lift the curse. And the final one, he passed one, he failed another. And then so the final one is he has to get through this maze. And again, we have this thing where the maze is alive itself, which I think we can talk about in a minute, having mazes that are alive.
Yeah.
Whereby it's a hedge maze, but of course vines start coming to life and they have to escape this maze, which is trying to kill them. And again, we have this alive maze in Labyrinth, almost, where things move. Or people move things for no particular reason.
Yes.
And again, the maze is alive at certain points in Harry Potter as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think in Harry Potter it was done better in the book because it was a series of tasks. There were riddles and things and
yeah,
creatures to fight off. It wasn't just a case of, oh, yeah, the bushes have come alive.
No, I did quite like the way that it was done in the books as well because, yeah, as you said, it was trials. But I think there's something very eerie. If you think about being lost somewhere and then being lost somewhere conscious of the fact that things are alive all around you, you are in the belly of the beast and you are at its mercy and you are at its peril.
Yeah.
It's terrifying. And I really like the way, like it when you get this real sense that the thing around me is alive. And actually, this is not about wit necessarily. It's not about cleverness. It could very much be down to luck.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, just the entire experience of being lost, being genuinely lost and not knowing if anyone can find you is pretty bad.
It is. It's not much fun. 10 out of 10 do not recommend.
So, I mean, if you take that and add something where you genuinely can't find your way out, with all you can do is get yourself more tangled and more lost because it's designed to trick and trap you, and then you make it alive and sentient. And it's like, no, I think I'll stay in bed that day. I'm good.
There was another version of that where the maze was alive, but actually the maze wasn't alive so much because it was alive, it was programmed. And that's the Maze Runner.
Yes, that was an interesting take on it. It's an okay book. I've not read the rest of the series yet. Mm. And he basically, the main character, starts off, I think to be honest, it was written initially to cash in on the Hunger Games.
Mm.
Which also have a sort of maze type feel because of the tasks and things.
Yeah.
But aside from that, it was to cash in on the Hunger Games with a male protagonist.
Mm.
But what it turns out to be is he's lowered into the maze in a cage in the first scene, and he can't really remember who he is. And he's got his name, but he can't remember how he got there or why he's there. And there are all these other boys there as well. And it's like the Lost Boys. And they get a certain number of supplies and things, and they learn to cooperate and work together. And the only way out is a maze which opens at a specific time at night and then closes completely during the day. And the maze is full of really dangerous stuff. You know, it's not somewhere you just want to stroll. But it turns out that the idea is that these kids have super smarts, as it were. And if they can navigate the maze, then they'll be the right sort of kids for the next level,
yes,
as it were. And they're basically, in a way, it's like lab rats. They make lab rats run through mazes and they give them electric shocks to teach them which turns are right and which aren't. And they're doing this basically with teenage boys and one teenage girl, because putting one teenage girl in with 20 teenage boys is a really good idea. But that aside, that's essentially what they're doing. They're trying to bring out this latent behaviour, this latent ability in these boys, because they need them for some sort of dystopian future task.
Yeah. And the scary thing is that the boys do die. There are boys who die.
Yeah, it is very survival of the fittest.
And also, actually, it's not just survival of the fit, it's survival of because actually they kind of create a discord between them. And the ones who can sort of survive as a group are the ones who are going to kind of get through it all. Whereas the ones who don't die horribly and painfully. And it's not much fun. And not only do they have this, they have these creatures in it as well. These creatures which are poisonous. And again, the maze moves every now and again.
Yeah, because what they do is they try and map the maze. And they try and map what sequence it changes in. There's different sections of the maze open. So it's not that they don't go about it in an intelligent way, but, you know, running the maze is just really, really risky.
Yeah. Because if you're trapped there, then you die.
Yeah, I mean, it is an interesting... In a way, it's an interesting thought experiment. Can you learn true cooperation unless your life depends on someone? Open question.
One of the interesting things, they kind of accept him, his name's Thomas, I think, they kind of accept him into the group because he and someone else get locked in the maze during the night and they manage to survive and come out the next morning.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, because I only saw the film, actually, I never read the book. I felt that the fear of being lost was never really explored.
I think you're probably right. It was more explored in the book. But then, to be honest, in the book, they were running so much from everything in the maze, from the maze itself,
that
being lost was very secondary.
But I didn't really find any moment where they were just sort of stood there like, oh God, where the hell are we? They always managed to find their way out, and you kind of always sort of felt like that they would. And it was almost like they got to the point where the maze was still an issue, but the maze was an issue because it was a puzzle and they couldn't figure it out, not because it was, they could run it. The few chosen ones to be runners, they could run it. And they always made a doubt. Not always.
It's been a long time since I read the book, and it, you know, it was an okay book, but it didn't make that great an impression on me. So hasn't stayed with me. It hasn't stayed with me in the same way that other books have.
So you keep going on about trials and their places and mazes.
Well, I think the maze itself is kind of a trial, but yeah, usually you'd have. I suppose where this has come from initially for me is and the maze I weirdly find most terrifying is the never-ending story at the very end, because the trials in that he's not confronting anything external. Ultimately, they're just facilitators. He's confronting the nasty pockets of his own nature. Atreyu, because Atreyu is obviously the one who goes through the maze.
Yeah.
And obviously in Harry Potter, it is a trial. You'd only get through the maze if you defeat the obstacles in your path. Mm. You solve the riddles. And I suppose you'd say the same in Labyrinth, really. It's full of riddles and traps.
Yeah. And again, you have that slightness in Hunger Games, in that it's a series of trials, one after the other. I guess it's almost the question is, can you have a maze that doesn't have any walls? Or doesn't have a kind of a place you can get lost in necessarily.
Well, I suppose the thing is, the original turf mazes were literally just patterns cut into the turf. So,
yeah,
you know, theoretically there are no walls.
Well,
you
I mean,
just step out if you wanted to, but
well, let's say you have a forest, right?
Yeah.
Could you say the forest is the maze? It doesn't necessarily create walls. You could go one way or the other, but you could still get lost.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there's a book by Diana Wynne Jones called Hexwood.
Mm-hmm.
Which, on the surface, looks like it's quite a simple young adult fairy tale type thing. And then when you read a bit more, you realise it's actually quite heavy-hitting science fiction with some really quite disturbing themes in it. And the Hexwood itself it's a forest that's conscious, ultimately, because it exists in a field of, I'm trying to think of the, it's, they call it a theta field, but that's just the name for what's giving off this particular energy, if you like.
Mm.
The forest itself weaves its own theta field and can change itself subtly, and it has power over time. So you may not ever come into it in the same part of the timeline that you were on before. So it's all about playing with your perceptions, and you never really know if you've got out of the Hexwood or not.
No, that's terrifying. Now here's a question. Could a dream be a maze?
Yes, and I think there are authors who've done that. There's Rose Madder by Stephen King,
mm-hmm.
which does take the whole sort of Minotaur, Erenyes the Bull, in a maze.
Yeah.
And basically the premise of Rose Madder is that Rosie McClendon is running away from her husband of 14 years, who is a violent brute, and seriously, literally no punches are pulled in that book as to what domestic violence is like. So, you know, it's all pretty horrific. She gets away from him, and she's quite clever at avoiding him to start with, because he's a cop, and his speciality is tracking people down.
Right.
And she's pretty sure that he's actually killed somebody because of this temper and whatever he's got. But she discovers a painting in a shop that she really likes that makes her feel better. And she's living in a woman's shelter at the time. She puts the painting on her wall, and then she starts having these really weird dreams where she has to navigate her way through a maze and avoid the creature that lives in the maze, because there's a child in the maze that needs to be rescued. The whole thing, I mean, if you read it, it's basically her reclaiming her sexuality after 14 years of rape and beatings, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But again, this is all done in a dream, if you like. The dream itself is a maze. The only way out of the dream is to solve the maze.
Yeah. And that actually makes me think there was a series recently, and I can't believe I've just forgotten the name. It was another one of the Marvel ones, and it had the guy who plays the Beast in the new Beauty and the Beast in it.
That probably, I'm not really great with actor names, so
yeah,
no help to you whatsoever.
His name is the character's name is, that's it, the series was called Legion. Very trippy, the first episode. I did not know what was going on. I wasn't sure I liked it, but then actually I really enjoyed the series. Now the premise is that within the sort of the Marvel universe, you don't really discover it in the series itself, but within the Marvel universe, David is Charles Xavier's son.
I did actually watch that.
Oh, you have watched Legion.
I have watched Legion. I didn't. It took me a moment to place it because I didn't realise that was the same actor.
Yeah, same guy.
Oh, there you go then. Yeah, no, it was really interesting. And he's pretty much imprisoned in his mind, isn't he?
He is. And that, especially the last kind of few episodes, there's a whole sequence where they're all imprisoned in his mind.
Yeah. Really disturbing.
It was terrifyingly disturbing. And there's all sorts of, and it is, I would say that kind of is a labyrinth, because things keep changing and they keep being faced with things and tasks and there are monsters, and I thought it was exceptional.
Yeah, it was very, very clever. And obviously deeply disturbing at the same time.
Very, very deeply disturbing. but very, very well done. Very well put together. Very well acted. And yeah, I think that managed to capture, because actually one of the scariest things of all was when they were separated. And being separated from people in a maze is pretty scary. Especially if a bunch of people are lost and you're all separated from each other. The sense of powerlessness. You know, if you're lost, but at least a few of you are together, then you still feel kind of like things can be all right.
Yeah.
We are social animals after all.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And the whole idea of all of you being lost within somebody's mind, and someone who has had years and years and layers of therapy and drugs and things messing him up, when really it was nothing to do with that. He's not, you know, he's not psychotic.
No,
he's a mutant.
Yeah, a mutant who's been possessed.
So yeah, there's all those different layers of difficulty there as well. I think it's really interesting that once again, you have yet another link between the idea of a labyrinth and the idea of a mind.
Yes, I agree. It really is. Sorry, I feel like sort of Illuminati discovered. Go back to labyrinths being shaped like brains, and here we are. The labyrinths are our minds.
Yes, they are. I mean, if you think about it quite literally, the place you are most likely to ever be imprisoned in your life is your own mind.
Oh, don't say that. That's terrifying.
It's terrifying, but if you accept it as, you know, that's a truth, that's a reality, that's also freeing, because if you have control over your own mind, then you're never really imprisoned.
True.
I've gone a bit esoteric, haven't I?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll leave that thought for now. In fact, we'll leave you on that thought, because we're pretty much at an end now.
We are. So I guess before we go, I guess it's rather stupid to ask, but what is your favourite labyrinth / maze story?
It has to be the original labyrinth, I'm afraid.
Yeah, that's fair. I'm a bit of a sucker for the Minotaur story. I feel like we forgot to mention Atlantis, the entire premise of the first episode is that he has to go into the labyrinth and Ariadne and all that. Even though it was the wrong guy, they got Jason doing it instead of Theseus.
That always really annoys me when they do that. Although I do feel a bit peeved with Theseus because, okay, you could say he was just being really time effective, but mm-hmm. seducing Ariadne and getting her to show him how to get through the maze, that seems like cheating to me, which is why I don't think he ever changes on his character arc. He still stays this arrogant sod who ends up getting his own father killed.
Well, I mean, he was just asleep at the time. Jeez, Jules.
No, he forgot to change the sails on his ship.
Yeah, and he also ended up abandoning Ariadne because he was asleep, and they just went, bye then!
Oh, I don't know, I've read versions where he actually deliberately abandoned her and had no intention.
True.
Like all great Greek heroes, he probably wasn't such a great guy.
No. They never usually are. So yeah, I'm a bit of a sucker for the original Minotaur myth. Even though I don't have a lot of love for Theseus, I did kind of like the whole idea of it. It's always sort of tickled my imagination. So yeah, I guess that's us for this week.
Yes, tell us about the mazes you like.
Or the mazes you don't. And have you ever got lost in a maze? Leave us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Thanks and bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.